Welcome to the Majewski lecture for this term. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Michael Barrower from the University of Cambridge from the Divinity Faculty, who's been there now for about a year, it must be. And
about 2 years. Yeah,
or 2 years. Time goes so quickly. And he's got interest in Hindu theological traditions, particularly the Ramanuja, and also Hindu-Christian interface. And he's got a book published with our series, Hindu Studies Series with Routledge, on Hindu-Christian conversion. And the precise title is, you'll tell us, is...
Debating Conversion.
Debating Conversion in Hinduism and Christianity. And that came out last year. So I would encourage you all to get that, to buy that. And today he's going to speak to us on the topic of... is it intolerant to convert other people? Very interesting question. Revisiting a vexed debate in Hindu-Christian dialogue. So, Dr. Barrower, over to you.
So, thank you, Gavin, and thank you all of you for turning up. Now, before I start talking about today's topic, let's see what's the time here. Let me first tell you why I wrote that book. So, when I was writing this book, I sort of realized that maybe when you write any book, there are two aspects to it. There is what you say in the book, and there is what you do not say in the book. And what you do not say in the book is what I'm telling you now. That is why I wrote that book. Now, when I look back on my childhood, I realize I had a very peculiar childhood. By some standards, it's very peculiar. Which is this, that on 2 days of the week, the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, I was raised in a devout Vaishnavite family. So, you know, it's a family which is charged with the poetry, the music, the literature of Vishnu. But my parents were Vaishnavites, devout Vaishnavites, but they were also academics. So they spent 5 days of the week in the library. And those 5 days of the week, I was raised by a devout Roman Catholic aunt. So I was raised as a Roman Catholic in a Vaishnavite family. Now, you might think that's a very good thing because, you know, it broadens the horizon of your mind and that sort of thing. But there's a downside to it. And the downside was, when I was around 15 years old, my mother died a very painful death. And I struggled to try to come to grips with her suffering. But the problem is, I had two answers to this. One is the Christian idea of the atonement, Christ's sacrificial death on the cross. And the other is the Vaishnavite understanding of karma and rebirth, the moral order which is governed by Krishna, or Vishnu. But the problem with me, from a conceptual point of view, is that I'm not exactly a Hindu who was raised as a Hindu and became interested in Christianity. Just as I'm not a Catholic who was raised as a Catholic and became interested in Hinduism. I'm a bit of a freak in interreligious dialogue. I was raised as Hindu-Catholic from day one. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that my parents and my aunt got together and said, you know, let's raise him in that way. I mean, this is how it just happened. You know, life moves in mysterious ways. And I was raised as a Hindu-Catholic from day one. So I had two answers. One is the Christian doctrine of the atonement, and the other is the Vaishnavite Hindu understanding of karma and rebirth. Which is the, so to speak, the ultimately true answer? I spent 25 years so far trying to answer that question, and in many ways, this is what I do not say in my book. My book is a record of my failure to answer that question. I have not yet succeeded in answering that question. Is it the Christian doctrine of the atonement? Is it the Hindu understanding of karma and rebirth or reincarnation or a third alternative? Who knows what my answer may be 5 years from today? But today, I just do not know. So this is my, so to speak, my hermeneutic perspective from which I approach this question. Is it intolerant to tell other people that you got it wrong? Is it intolerant to tell people that X is partially true, maybe even incorrect, therefore you should move towards Y? And this is a question that I've struggled with for a very long time. So what is that X? Is that X Roman Catholicism? Is that X Vaishnavite Hinduism? Or is that X a third alternative? Now with that background to what brought me to write a book, let's straight away tackle this question. Is it intolerant to convert other people? Now, the problem with that sort of a question is that you need to define your terms, as philosophers will tell you. So what is toleration and what is conversion? Now, unfortunately for my purpose, these two terms, toleration and conversion, are one of the most, or two of the most slippery terms, conceptually speaking. Conversion can mean all kinds of things to people. Toleration can mean all kinds of things to people. Let's start with toleration. A recent volume on toleration calls toleration an elusive virtue. What does it mean to tolerate other people? Now let's look at two things which toleration is quite often, I would argue, confused. Confused in the sense that the Hindu thinkers and the Christian theologians I will discuss today do not mean by toleration indifferentism and skepticism. That is, I can just be indifferent to what other people think, what other people believe. That is not how these thinkers, the ones I will discuss today, understand toleration. Toleration. So to tolerate X does not mean to be indifferent to X. And number two, to tolerate X does not mean, and that is in the light of the figures I will discuss today, to be skeptical about the possibility of arriving at the final truth. Okay. So you may have only a partial glimpse as to what that final truth is, but that partial glimpse is, for that matter, very real. Okay. Now the dividing line between tolerating X and being indifferent to X is a very slippery one. It depends on where you are located. So for example, let me invent a figure called, quote-unquote, the average Anglican. And suppose today I were to go to the average Anglican and ask him or her, do you tolerate Catholics? The average Anglican today might say, what do you mean? Of course I tolerate Catholics. I don't even care what Catholics believe. But as you know, 100 years ago or 150 years ago, tolerating Catholics was a serious business. Till 1880s, if you were a Catholic, you could not graduate or matriculate at Oxford. Okay? So you can see how the dividing line between being indifferent to X and tolerating X can shift historically, temporally. So that is part of the problem as to what do I mean when I say I'm tolerating someone. Now, to tolerate someone, this is something that some philosophers have worked out. I'm simply drawing upon their work. Requires, from an analytic point of view, at least three components. Firstly, you cannot tolerate something or someone or a practice that you agree with. It would be very odd to say that I tolerate my friends. So number one, to tolerate X, which is a belief or a viewpoint or a standpoint or a practice, you should think that X is either wrong, incorrect, or partially correct. Okay? Say, for example, it would be very odd for the UN Secretary General to say, I tolerate human rights. Okay. So you do not tolerate something that you think is correct. And number two, you tolerate X if you are in a position to eradicate or remove or obliterate X, and yet you do not. Suppose I am a prisoner of war in the Second World War. It would be very odd on my part to say I tolerate my prison guards. Well, I have no other option. You know, I mean, this is what I am. I'm trapped, I'm caught here. I'm in no position to run out of the prison house or prison camp. And finally, this is the paradox. Somehow, although I think that X is incorrect, partially correct, or completely wrong, I exercise a voluntary self-restraint in not preventing the propagation of X. So that is the paradox. On the one hand, I think X is incorrect. X is implausible, incoherent, morally not justifiable, and yet I voluntarily do not seek to obliterate it, to eradicate it. Which gives rise to this paradox, which I quote from the political theorist Susan Mendoza. She says, normally we count toleration as a virtue in individuals and in duty in societies. However, when toleration is based on moral disapproval, it implies that a thing tolerated is wrong. The question then arises, why should it be thought good to tolerate? So if I think that X, say, genocidal violence, is immoral, if I tolerate genocidal violence, why do I do this? Are there any moral limits to toleration? So that is the problem. Now, the way in which some political theorists, such as Mendoza herself, have dealt with this paradox is to say that the virtue of toleration makes sense only when you are dealing with ranked priorities. That is, you have a second order or a higher order reason to allow a lower order practice or belief to flourish. Now, here's a very straightforward example. Suppose my niece likes to listen to rock group X, Y, and Z. And I think rock group X, Y, and Z has terrible aesthetic sense. And yet I allow my niece to play rock group X, Y, and Z because, shall we say, I read my Immanuel Kant and I believe in respect for persons. So I have a second order reason, a higher order reason called respect for persons, for the importance of human autonomy, which allows me to say I will yet not interfere with my niece's choice of music. Does it mean that I agree with her? No. I think she got it wrong. I think she should not listen to X, Y, and Z. I think she should listen to whatever. She should listen to the Bowels of Bengal, or she should listen to Beethoven, or whatever. But yet, I do not go into the room and tell her, you got it wrong. So this is very important to note. To tolerate someone does not mean that you think that they got it wrong, but you have some higher order reason to exercise this voluntary self-restraint. Now the debate really is, as I will show today, in Hindu-Christian dialogue, the question, what is that higher order reason? What is that higher order reason that prevents you from going into your, shall we say, your neighbor's house and telling them that you should stop doing what you are doing? Are there such reasons? Okay. Now let's move on to this. Now here's an argument that I use in my book, which will at once, one stroke, settle forever the question of conversion and toleration. Suppose this argument were to go through. Suppose we were able to say that truth values are equally, and the emphasis is on equally, are equally distributed across the various religious matrices of the world. So Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, which has numerous components, they equally have different forms of the same truth. Okay. Now, that is your modus ponens. Now, if premise two were to be correct, then conversions will become metaphysically pointless. The really crucial part of this argument is the equally. If they're equally distributed, then conversions will be pointless. They will be metaphysically futile. Why would you convert to A, B, or C if you have an equal distribution of truth? Now, let me begin by saying, I don't want to be too provocative, but many people think that according to Hinduism, premise two is true. But all you need to do is study Hindu thought for 1 month, you will realize that no Hindu tradition has accepted premise two. So why is it that so many people think that according to the Hindu traditions, premise two is true? There are complex reasons, some of which I will discuss today. Okay, but keep this argument in mind. If premise two were to be true, then conversions are metaphysically impossible, not just sociologically. So when I say something is metaphysically impossible, that is your negative gold standard. That's the end of the matter. You know, just as you cannot have 3 atoms of hydrogen and 1 atom of oxygen in H2O. Likewise, if this argument premise were to be true, you know, that's the end of conversion. I mean, why would you do such a thing? It's not just sociologically superfluous, but metaphysically impossible. Okay. Now, today what I'm going to show is that there are two statements. So here's the here's one look at it. Now, this is how the Hinduism, quote-unquote Hinduism, versus quote-unquote Christianity contrast is usually put forward, almost as a civilizational clash. So on the left, according to this presentation, Hinduism believes that all religious pathways, all religious traditions lead to the same ultimate, whereas Christianity believes that only one of them, the Christian way, I'm the way, the truth and the life, leads to the same ultimate. Okay? Now, what I'm going to show to you today is that there is a grain of truth in this civilizational clash-like opposition, but only a grain of truth. And isolating that grain of truth is a very tricky business. Okay? Now, here's one way of doing it. Think of this as the first statement, and think of that as the first statement, the second one. Quite often, the first statement is conflated with the second. It is possible to accept the first to be true and say that the second is false. That is, I can believe that all religious traditions somehow, I don't know how, but somehow, in the great mystery of of providential economy or something like that, they lead to the same ultimate, and yet deny the second premise. And what I will argue today, and those of you who have studied Hindu thought will know, this is actually a very straightforward matter, that no Hindu major religious Hindu tradition has accepted the second premise. So again, without trying to be too provocative, I think that there is only one major modern Hindu figure who has accepted the second one, and I will tell you who he is. Okay, so think of it. That is, in the last 200 years, I think there's only one Hindu figure who has come close to saying something like that. Okay, so let's move on with this. Now, here are some standard metaphors. Many rivers lead to the same ocean. Many flowers, same garden. Many notes, same orchestra. Many roads, same summit. These are standard Hindu metaphors. How, doesn't matter what you believe, doesn't matter what you think, you are all moving towards the same summit. Now, as I said in the beginning, there's a grain of truth, and here is the grain of truth. But what exactly is that sea? What exactly is that garland? And what exactly is that orchestra? So this is what we need to be very careful about. What is it that we are all moving towards? It's not Jesus Christ. It's not Yahweh. It's not Allah. It's a very specific understanding of what exactly that sea is. What exactly that garden is. What exactly that orchestra is. And so let's have a look at this. So let's start with Swami Vivekananda. And there is this famous, as you know, his speech at the Parliament of World Religions in 1893. That brothers and sisters of America, as all the rivers of the ocean flow in the same water, same ocean, a metaphor which he picks up from the Upanishads, then he says that our religion, that is Hinduism, is the one that has taught tolerance and universal acceptance. And I'm proud to belong to a nation which has sheltered the persecuted and people who are suffering from all kinds of religious violence. Now this leads us to a very complicated topic, so complicated that I do not deal with it even in my book. So I'm not going to deal with it now. That is, what is the relation between religion and violence? All that I will tell you today is that I think this is the wrong way to answer the question. That is, by saying the relation is this, that Christianity causes violence and Hinduism causes peace. You don't even have to read David Hume to know that there are all kinds of problems there. All you need to know is that Christianity and Hinduism, in sentences such as these, are just abstractions. When I say that a certain form of Christianity, a certain historically shaped aspect of Hinduism, has given rise to certain kinds of violence, or has been associated with a certain kind of violence, all I mean to say is this, that certain beliefs drawn from the New Testament, or maybe from some Hindu scripture, has become associated, has become mediated through various complex historical forces, such as shifting balances of political power, court intrigue, patriarchal constructions, economic instabilities, have become associated with certain kinds of violence. The right way to explain this is not to go into what I call this comparative martyrdom by saying, well, you know, in Christendom, so many witches were burned, and in Hinduism, so many women committed sati. That don't get us anywhere by tabulating these sort of facts. What we need to know is the truth claims which undergird, which gives rise to this sort of violence. And this is the question that I now come to, the question of truth. What I'm going to show you now today is the kinds of Hindu religious, philosophical, metaphysical traditions that I will discuss have this way of positioning, locating the religion vis-a-vis the religions. So there is this capital R religion and small r religion. Now the $1 billion, or if you prefer the £1 billion question, is again, which is the religion? So that all these different strands that I will discuss today share the same logical structure. The debate is not over logic. The debate is over content. That is, what in fact is the religion. Okay. So let's have a look at these two. Now here's a figure called, well, I mean, of course you know who Swami Vivekananda is, Let me read it out quickly. Swami Vivekananda says, ours is the universal religion, as we will find out very soon. What he means by the universal religion, here is a certain kind of Advaita Vedanta. It is inclusive enough, it is broad enough to include all the ideals. All the ideals can be included in the infinite arms of the religion of the Vedanta. Now, there is a famous debate which took place in British India around this time between this figure, between the Scotsman, John Muir. Now, look at what he says. Only Christianity is universal. Okay. The whole human species has sinned. Christ came for the justification. Westerners, Yavanas, and Indians, the culture and the barbaric have all become coherent because of his grace. Now, if you unpack the logical structure of these two claims, you will see they have the same logical structure. The debate is over the content. What, in fact, is the religion? From Swami Vivekananda's point of view, the reason why Hinduism is universal is because our religion is Advaita Vedanta. Whereas from our friend John Muir's point of view, the reason why Christianity is universal is because our religion is Christianity. Okay. So what you see is two different strategies of accommodating, absorbing, assimilating religious diversity by positioning religious diversity vis-a-vis the same apex. Sorry, two different apex. So in this case, the apex is, the summit is Advaita Vedanta. In that case, the apex of the summit is Christianity. Okay. Now, why is it the case that quite often we think that religious truth claims are made only in Christianity and not in Hinduism? Now, let's pursue this point. Okay, let's look at what Paul Griffiths has to say. Now, Paul Griffiths, who is, well, as a matter of fact, he happens to be Catholic, but he is also a Buddhologist. He writes extensively on Buddhism. Religious claims to truth are typically absolute claims. All right, so far. But let's read the second part. These tendencies to absoluteness, although they have certainly been typical of Christian doctrines, are not typical only of them. They are characteristic also of many of the most interesting claims made by the religious virtuosi of a non-Christian tradition. So let's emphasize the second part. Most interesting claims made by the religious virtuosi of non-Christian tradition. And this is what we're going to look at today. How quite a few very important Hindu figures have also made precisely such absolute claims. That ultimately, not penultimately, ultimately there is only one truth. Whether this is Advaita Vedanta, Vishnu, Shiva, or something else. Okay. Now, why is the question of truth so important? And here is our friend Louis Rambo. I say, well, maybe not our, my friend, definitely, because I use quite a lot of Rambo in my work. Look at the crucial difference between the insider's perspective and the outsider's perspective. A religion's insiders assume that one converts to their religion because the religion is true. An outsider never asserts that someone converts to religion that is different because it's true. That is, if I'm a Catholic and I find my friend becoming a Catholic, what I will say, well, of course I told you so. But if I'm not a Catholic and my friend becomes a Catholic, I will say, you are being subject to some kind of hallucination. That must be true. Okay. So what is really going on here is the truth claim. Who got it right? Did the Catholics get it right? Did the Muslims, did the atheists, did the Hindus, or various tribes? The truth question is extremely important. This is the point that I make in my argument, okay, in my book. Now, let's have a look at two of figures of what is called modern Hinduism. Now, Ram Mohan Roy, he is writing this sometime around 1829, is already saying this. It is well known to the whole world that no people on earth are more tolerant than the Hindus. Okay? That is, we Hindus are the most tolerant of all people. And roughly, what, how many? About, roughly 100 years later, Radhakrishnan, well, it's sort of interesting that I'm speaking about Radhakrishnan in his own territory. This is Oxford, where he was the first Spalding professor of Eastern religions. And look at what Radhakrishnan says. By accepting the significance of the diverse intuitions of reality and the different scriptures, Hinduism has become a tapestry. So here's one more metaphor. Many rivers, same ocean, many chords, same orchestra, many roles, same summit, and this time, many intuitions, same tapestry. Now, whenever you read Radhakrishnan saying things like this, it's very important that we do not quote him out of context. Immediately after saying something like this, Radhakrishnan will also tell you something like that, which is, the worshippers of the Absolute are the highest. Second to them are the worshippers of the personal God. Then come the worshippers of various avatars or incarnations. And below them are those who worship ancestors. Okay. So you have to combine the two sides, the two aspects of Radhakrishnan. And Radhakrishnan goes on to say something which is very important for our topic today. He specifically says this. Hinduism does not mistake tolerance for indifference. Therefore, I go back to my first point that none of the figures I'm discussing today would think to tolerate X means, well, I don't care about X. It means that you got it wrong. But there's a reason why you got it wrong. From Radhakrishnan's Advaita point of view, it's called avidya. Okay, because of avidya, because of karma, that is why you got it wrong. It affirms that while all revelations refer to reality, with a capital R, they are not equally true. While the lesser forms are tolerated in the interest of those who cannot suddenly transcend them, and what are these lesser forms? All these popular Hindus who worship Vishnu, who worship Krishna, who worship Rama and things like that, we will tolerate them. Because eventually they will get there. Maybe not this lifetime, they will require a lot of time. They will require many several lifetimes, but they will get there. So that is the sort of cosmic fate, what you might call some sort of an Advaita faith. Hinduism does not believe in forcing up the pace of development. So this is the crucial point. The reason why you do not find this sort of crusading mentality in Hinduism is not because of a doctrinal nihilism. It's not because Hindus don't care what you believe. It is because it does not matter what you believe, because you will get there eventually. Okay? That is, if not in this lifetime, you will have enough ample opportunities to purify the self and gradually make progress, if not in this lifetime, in a subsequent lifetime. Says who? Here's one example of such an argument. Well, sorry, I moved a bit too fast. Here's one example. So in the first convention of the Ramakrishna Mission in 1926 by Chairman Swami Sharodananda, this is what he says. Every sincere devotee will have to pass through the three stages. The lowest stage is dualism. Slightly higher is qualifying monism. These are just technical terms for, shall we say, Madhva, Ramanuja, and Shankar. Okay, and ultimately monism. Then there need not be any quarrel. Don't fight. I mean, we Advaita people, we don't fight with you. Because I know you will get there. I don't mean to say tomorrow. You know, we have enough time. Time is never a problem in the Hindu religious universes. There's enough time. The kind of time stretches I'm talking about are truly mind-boggling. We will all get there. So this is the cosmic faith. And look at the third one. This is very crucial. Stick to your own religion. Do not try to move across religious affiliations or boundaries and think that the followers of other religions, such as Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, and Sikhism, are coming to the same goal. And what he means by the same goal, if you read that quotation in the proper context, is transpersonal Advaita through different paths. So that is the same goal that everyone is moving towards. Okay. Therefore, to come back to our friend Swami Vivekananda here, what exactly did Swami Vivekananda say is a very tricky topic, and I'm not going to settle it here, but on some occasions, such as this one, Swami Vivekananda was very forthright. He would say that Madhva or Ramanuja clearly got it wrong. Because if you are in a theistic tradition of Advaita, this is just a part which are struggling to attain the cosmic vision of the whole. And by the whole, that is by the sea, by the garden, by the orchestra, by the summit, he means Advaita Vedanta. So one has to be very careful about what is the sea here? What is the garden here? What is the ocean here? And here is Vivekananda's understanding of Christ, which is a very, I mean, I have to say, very common understanding in the Hindu polemical literature on Christian conversion, which is this, to put it very bluntly. The problem with Christians is that they have misunderstood their Christianity. Who is Jesus Christ really? Jesus Christ really is an unviking, and he got it wrong. And because Jesus Christ could not understand that he was really, appearances notwithstanding, an unviking, that is why you have all this problem about conversion. There is no need to convert anyone, because we are all unvikings anyway. And let's have a look at this one. So, to the masses who could not conceive of anything higher than a personal God, they said, pray to your Father in heaven. To others who could grasp a higher idea, that is, to the others who could read John's Gospel, he said, I'm the vine and you're the branches. Sorry. But to his disciples, whom he revealed himself more fully, that is to the real Advaitins, he proclaimed the highest truth. I am the Father, our Advaita. Okay? So this is what is going on. That is what I say. That is when I say the same garden, same ocean, same summit, or same path, same goal, it is Advaita. Now, let me see if I can give you another example of this. Okay. Now, regarding rebirth, this is why the idea of rebirth is so crucial in Hindu-Christian understanding. Now here is Chandrasekhara Saraswati, the spiritual head, the Acharya of Kanchi, which is in the Advaita lineage. He says, the frail mind must go from the concrete to the abstract, from the form of gods in images to the formless absolute. Therefore, when all paths in religion lead to the same goal, there will be no need to change any path. What is this all talk about conversion, about Muslims trying to become Christian, about Christians trying to become Hindus, Hindus trying to become Christians? This is all metaphysically superfluous. Sociologically, it's pointless. Don't you see that you are already the Advaita Absolute? It is because you do not have this truth in you, because you suffer from avidya, that you think by entering into the church, some good thing will happen to me. But you are already the Advaita Absolute. So why even take the trouble? So just stick to your Hinduism, stick to your Islam, stick to your Judaism, and pursue your independent dharma. And finally, in terms of the cosmic fate, you will get there. But by there I don't mean Jesus Christ. By there I mean the Nirguna Brahman. Okay? So this is this person. And let's have a look at a very similar quotation from Chandrasekhara Bharati this time. So he is now the Acharya of the Sringeri Monastery. So, I mean, all these mathas, as they're called, or monasteries, are in the Advaita lineages. So, here's a person who wanted to, here's an American tourist who went to this matha and said, you know, I want to become a Hindu. And this, I want to become a Hindu. And this is what Bharati is saying. Bharati is saying, it's no freak that you were born as a Christian. God, and by God he means Ishwara, not Brahman, ordained it that way because by the samskaras that you have acquired over many, many, many previous births, that is why you were born into Krishna Dharma. That is why you were born into a Christian context. You might think that there was some sort of providential economy as to why you were born into Christian parents, but actually that's not true. It's a part of your previous karma. Why you were born in, say, London to a Christian family. This is your karmic retribution. And you have to work it out within a Christian context. So in and through your Christianity, you will reach the Advaitic Absolute. So again, conversion is metaphysically impossible and sociologically superfluous. Why would you try to do such a thing when you can already have it here, straight away? Now here is Swami Shivananda, who you might know is the founder of the Divine Life Society. Now let's have a look at what he says. Non-dualism is the highest realization. And the theistic Dvaitin and the Vishishta Dvaitin will eventually reach the Advaitic goal. Okay. Now all the examples I've given you so far are examples from, say, modern or new Advaitins. But what about the Vaishnavas? What do they have to say? So let's move to Swami Prabhupada. Now the founder of ISKCON, Swami Prabhupada, this is what he has to say. A directly Krishna-conscious person is the topmost transcendentalist. because such a person truly knows what is meant by Brahman and Paramatma. His knowledge of the Absolute is perfect, whereas the transpersonalist Advaita thinker and the yogi are only imperfectly Krishna conscious. Now, a figure who was contemporaneous, more or less, with Prabhupada, this figure called Swami Bon Maharaj, he brings together many of the arguments that I have been discussing so far here. He says, an individual must have developed through practices in various previous births a given degree of spiritual maturity before he or she can be reborn in a Hindu family to practice, to have the adhikara to practice Hinduism. Now, who is Swami Bon Maharaj? He was a disciple of Bhaktivedanta Saraswati. Now, this is what he had to say. The Lord Krishna desires his word to be preached to all living beings. So he would send his disciples, his followers from Bengal to Europe, to Germany, to England, to preach the word of Krishna. And it's very important that it is for him. It is not just any Lord. Not just any Lord will do. It has to be the Lord Krishna. It's not even Vishnu. It is the Lord Krishna. It is not Shiva. And it is definitely, emphatically, not Advaita Vedanta. So this is the Hindu side of the debate. Sorry, this is the Vaishnava side of the debate. Let me summarize this entire argument by bringing together in one slide two quotations. Now here is Radhakrishna. Advaita Vedanta is not a religion. It is religion itself in the deepest sense of the term. Now I don't know enough about Prabhupada to know whether Prabhupada actually read Radhakrishna. But I suspect he did, because if you look at that quotation, it uses the same turn of phrase. The religion of the Bhagavad Gita is not Hinduism or Christianity, it is not a religion, but it is the essence of religion. It is the sara, okay? The very culminating essence of religion is Bhagavad Gita. And to accept Krishna as our Lord, this is bhakti or vairagya. So we come back to the slide I showed you there. The religion is viewed as the summation, as the pinnacle, as the apex of the imperfect, partial religious strivings of humanity. The debate is again not over the logical structure but over material content. Who got it right? Is it Vishnu? Is it Shiva? Is it Jesus Christ? Or is it a third alternative or a fourth alternative? Who got it right? Now, the figures that I've discussed so far are all pretty recent figures, Radhakrishnan, Bhaktivedanta, and the other person I showed you just now. What about medieval and classical Hinduism? Let's have a quick look at some figures from medieval Hinduism. Now, here is a figure called Pillan, who was a disciple of Ramanuja in the 12th century, 11th century. Now, Pillan is trying to answer the question, why are there so many gods? You know, we all know it is Vishnu Narayana who is the personal absolute. But then why is there Shiva? Why do the texts talk about Brahma? Why do they talk about various kinds of deities? And look at Pillan's rather ingenuous reply. He says, if everyone were to get liberated, then samsara will come to an end. Therefore, it is Lord Vishnu Narayana himself who has told his devotees who do not want to arrive at him, that is Vishnu, that at least in this lifetime, you go and worship Shiva. And eventually, you will come to me. Okay. So, once again, the importance, the centrality of the truth claim about karma and rebirth. Okay. This entire structure will collapse if one has the arguments as to why the doctrine of karma and rebirth is incoherent or implausible or cannot be justified. That is, of course, a big if. But everything turns around that big if. Now, here's an example from a Shaivite text. The Shiva Jnana Chittiyar, this time this is Shaiva Siddhanta, and look at the detailed list he gives in order of decreasing error. So the people who got it completely wrong are the Lokayatas, the materialists. I mean, these are the standard people who nobody likes in classical Indian philosophy. But the non-theistic schools, number two, Mimamsa. And then if you go down, or rather go up, number 8, devotees of Narayana. So the devotees of Narayana almost got there, but not quite, because the highest is Shiva. Okay, so this is your the other way of looking at it. And if you walk, or rather move down the centuries, here is Madhava, not the Hindu theologian Madhava, but this is the Advaita Madhava, roughly 13th century. Now he has a very similar argument. So first, at the bottom of the pile are your Charvakas. The Charvakas will be sublated or superseded by the Buddhists, and you have this whole list, all the way from the Charvakas to Advaita Vedanta. Now, let's come to Radhakrishnan. I showed you this some time ago. Now, can you see the direct causal or historical link between Madhva in the 14th century and Radhakrishnan in 1928? What Radhakrishnan has done, he has picked up this template of arranging religious traditions, religious views, and saying that the apex, the pinnacle, the summit is Advaita Vedanta, and repositioning the others vis-a-vis Advaita Vedanta. So here is Madhva in the 14th century. And exactly the same logical structure turns up in Radhakrishnan in 1928. Okay. From all of this, this is the conclusion that we arrive at. Conclusion 1 and conclusion 2. Not all the religious traditions of the world are directing their adherence towards X. Most forms of Christian theology and Hindu thought, as we have discussed today, accept conclusion 1. Not all of them are directing you towards X. Because what is X? Could be Advaita Vedanta, could be Vishnu, could be Shiva, could be various other minor deities. And number 2, regarding the religious traditions that we noted here, it may be possible, and that may is very crucial, it may be possible to place them on such a scale that we can say some of them are more X-directed and some of them are less X-directed. Now, the reason why I say may here, I will not discuss in great detail today, but that is because of what I call in my book, Carl's Kaleidoscope. That is, if you are a big fan of Karl Barth, then you will say no, that is, you will not accept this. But if you're a fan of Karl Rahner, you will say yes. Is it possible to say that there are many different religious traditions and you can arrange them on the religious spectrum? The Barthian position, more or less, is no. The Rahnerian position is more or less yes. Okay. So it's a major Christian complication, which is why I will not discuss here. But these are the two conclusions that we have arrived today. That is, both the Christian traditions and most of the Hindu traditions that we have discussed today, they accept conclusion 1 and they accept conclusion 2. Therefore, again, the argument is not over logical structure. The argument is over metaphysical content. What is X? Is X Advaita Vedanta? Is X Vishnu? Is X Shiva? Is X Jesus Christ? Is X metaphysical naturalism? Is X agnosticism? Is X various other combinations are possible. So ultimately, it always comes down to the question of truth claims. Who got it right? Okay. Therefore, here is the other point that I would like to emphasize before I end very quickly. Now, I think, in the course of writing my book, I felt that many people many people struggle with this sort of a confusion that universality and particularity are opposed. As a matter of fact, universality and particularity are dialectically entangled. You can only talk about universality if you're looking at the world through a particular pivot or a particular focus. So the debate is, what is that pivot? What is that focus? So look at the logical structure of what I call Christian theology and classical Advaita. According to Christian theology, all human beings can be saved. But there is only one way to do this, Jesus Christ. Likewise, according to classical Advaita, all human beings can attain moksha. Well, although in classical Advaita there is a problem with all. But let's not worry about that. All human beings can attain liberation. But there is only one way to do this. Not by reading your Madhva, not by reading your Ramanuja. is by developing this form of sort of intuitive self-realization of nirguna Brahman. So what you see in CT and CA is again the same logical structure. There's only one way you can attain salvation, Jesus Christ. There's only one way in which you can attain liberation, moksha, through the Guru, through the Upanishads. So the debate again is over content. Who got it right then? Is it Advaita Vedanta, or is it Jesus Christ? And finally, I think I just have 2 minutes to squeeze this in. Okay. Now, this particular side is not, shall we say, from Hindu thought, but from Jainism, what is today called Jainism, that is Anekantavada. Okay. Now, here's one sort of footnote about Anekantavada. Many people will argue in this way. Why not use Anekantavada? Well, that is a Jaina view that reality is so complicated, so complex, that all standpoints are partially true, relative to where you stand. Okay. So somehow Buddhist thought is true, somehow the Vedantic doctrine is true, somehow Christianity is true, somehow everything is true. Now the problem with using Anekantavada in such a context is this. In classical Jaina texts, they do not say that the omniscience of the Jaina himself is subject to relativization. The Jaina, the omniscient Jaina, got it right all the way. The reason why you as a Buddhist, as a Hindu, as a Christian, as a Muslim, have to struggle with partial views is precisely because you are not the Jaina. If you were to be the omniscient Jaina, then you will know exactly what it is. So again, even Anekantavada will not help you. You will have to go back to the question of what is X according to the omniscient realized person, in this case, Ujja Jaina. Okay. So what I hope to have sort of demonstrated in these 50 minutes is not to settle the metaphysical question of what is X. In the course of writing this book, I have come to believe more and more that this question can only be answered on the other side of the grave. Okay. That is, if I meet you there, I will tell you what I found there. But what I have tried to focus here on is the logical structure. That is, from a logical point of view, the Hindu approach to religious diversity and the Christian understanding to religious diversity are logically at par. They're epistemic peers. It's not as if the Hindus have got some sort of a blinding vision of reality as it is. These are all epistemic standpoints as to what X is like. And this dialectical structure of the religion versus the religions appears in Christian theology, appears in Radhakrishnan, appears in Vivekananda, appears in Bhaktivedanta Saraswati, it appears in all major classical, medieval, and modern Hindu theology. Therefore, the debate is not over who is more tolerant, but which toleration are we talking about. Right. So I think I should stop now.
Thank you very much.